Okay, today I'm going to talk about the period from the outbreak of the Second World War in Europe in September of 1939 down to the expansion of the war into a truly global conflict with the Japanese attack on the United States at Pearl Harbor in December 7th, 1941, and then 4 days later, the German declaration of war in the United States. This is really an extraordinary period, an extraordinarily interesting period from the standpoint of the questions that we're concerned with, because as you get into this story, it becomes quite clear that these notions that you've absorbed from the world around you about what makes for war do not come close to capturing the reality. You know, this whole notion of how do you explain the Second World War? Well, you know, look at Hitler. Look how aggressive he was. Look at, you know, how he had a kind of lust for war. He decided to you know, start the war in September 1939, and then, you know, he attacked the Soviet Union in June of 1941 essentially for ideological reasons, with the aim of, you know, carving out a great German empire in the East and settling that area with Germans. And then he attacked America because, you know, he was so, you know, bellicose and, you know, just like a rabbit foaming at the mouth. Same thing about the Japanese, you know, war crazed lunatics, fanatics. You know, they had committed one act of aggression after another in the 1930s, beginning with their conquest of Manchuria in 1931. And you know, as though this war with China wasn't enough for them, they just attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor, bolt from the blue. You know, that's how the Second World War is to be understood. You want to understand the war in Europe? Hitler. You want to understand the war in the Pacific War, America's entry into the war? Pearl Harbor. You know, very simple, very interesting. It turns out, not only is that whole way of looking at these things is just unwarranted, but when you get into the story, it sheds an extraordinary amount of light on these issues that international relations theorists are interested in, especially all these issues connected with realism, with the role of power, with a relatively amoral dynamic underlying the course of events, having to do with power realities. You know, instead of Hitler and Japan deliberately, you know, setting their countries on a course for war with the United States, turns out that's the last thing that they wanted was, at this particular point in time, was a war with America, especially in the case of Japan. How did it happen? Put it this way. How do you go about sorting out this issue? How do you go about getting to the bottom of this whole set of questions, figuring out, you know, what the logic was that underlay the course of events from September of 1939 through December of 1941? How do you do it? All right. Now, it turns out I have this book that I wrote on historical method. And there's a chapter in that book that lays out this whole process of how you can get to the bottom of this particular historical issue, the issue especially of America's road to war in 1941. how the Second World War became a global conflict, not just a local European affair. And I took that chapter and I put it on the course website for this week. And so if you want to kind of see in much greater detail the sort of thinking that underpins the argument I'm going to lay out to you today, read it. It's an unusual piece in that it's not straight historical thing. It's like the whole idea is to kind of open up the doors of the workshop and have people who are non-professionals come in and see how an interpretation in practice actually gets hammered out. But it deals with this issue of 1941. And for me, all this stuff was just so surprising. Just this is one of the things that played a key role in shaping my own understanding of how international politics works. So how do you begin? How do you start? The whole intellectual journey begins, in effect, with bringing general insights that we associate with international relations theory to bear. Right? Generally, you hold up the standard of rationality. Does what you see make sense in its own terms? And it's not just at a general level that you do that. You bring that question into focus by reacting to very specific claims that scholars have made. For example, remember last time I talked at some length about the A.J.P. Taylor book, The Origins of the Second World War? The very last paragraph in that book. You know how big I am about first and last paragraphs. The last paragraph in that book. He talks about how Hitler gratuitously destroyed the source of his success. In 1941, he attacked Soviet Russia and declared war on the United States, two world powers who asked only to be left alone. You know, it was gratuitous. America asked only to be left alone. Russia asked only to be left alone. They weren't playing a role in the story. They were isolationists. They were turning their backs on Europe. They wouldn't have lifted a finger to prevent Hitler from doing whatever he wanted to do. It was the ball was entirely in Hitler's court. Hitler was the one who was calling the shots at this point, right? Gratuitously attack, you know, goes to war with America. He said to himself, this doesn't make sense. You look at the situation in December 1941. Hitler had attacked the Soviet Union in June after some really amazing initial successes. German offensive bogged down. The Germans were unable to bring about the collapse of the Soviet regime as they had hoped. And they have their hands full with Russia, a war to the death with Russia. In such circumstances, they're going to gratuitously pick a conflict with by far the strongest country in the world in terms of its mobilizable war potential. Not forces in being yet, because America had not really rearmed yet, but in terms of its industrial capacity. You know, I mean, look. You know, if you look at some of the figures for steel production in this period, Germany, Japan, and the United States, they're not in the same ballpark. The United States outproduces Japan in steel in those days by a factor of 7 to 1. I mean, it's... How do you explain it? How do you explain it? You're going to say, well, Hitler is just a lunatic. He lost... He just lost control of his senses. He was doing this stuff in a totally crazy thing. Well, you're all in analyzing these things, you're always very reluctant to opt for interpretations of that sort. You first want to push the rational interpretation as far as it goes. Is there a rational explanation for why events took the course they did, culminating in America being at war with Germany and Japan by the end of 1941. Right? How do you go about getting at that? Well, by reconstructing the story. And what's the basic story? It began in September 1939. Germany beats Poland, as everyone expected. Remember, this was not a war that Germany wanted at this time. Germany accepted as inevitable the idea of a conflict with the Western powers. But Hitler had thought that he could put off this conflict until like 1943 to 45. What's the proof of that? For example, all these German armaments programs, especially the German naval program, they had not come close to, you know, achieving their goals. The shift in the balance of military power that the Germans were aiming at was to take place a few years later. The Germans didn't have a plan for the for successfully fighting a war with the Western powers when the war broke out in 1939. No equivalent to the Schlieffen Plan. Right? The German goal is to deter the West from intervening. The Nazi-Soviet Pact, a key development, took place right on the eve of the war. The main goal of the Nazi-Soviet Pact was to show the British and the French that intervention on behalf of Poland was hopeless. You know, because there would be no way in which Poland could be defended. Just look at the map. I have to say that for me, one of the key pieces of evidence that supported this view, you know, kind of like the clinching argument that Hitler had not intended the war of 1939, was that when word was received from London that Britain had declared war on Germany, Hitler turned to his foreign minister, Ribbentrop, and he says to him in German, you know, was nun, you know, what do we do now? It's like, doesn't mean that Hitler was not aggressive, doesn't mean that he was this innocent victim of forces that were beyond his control, but he had lost control of these things. That's the problem with these deterrence crises. You know, each side is trying to deter the other. The British are trying to deter the Germans from moving east. The Germans are trying to deter the British from intervening on behalf of the Poles. In order to make your threats credible, you have to kind of get in deeper and deeper and deeper. But the deeper you get in, the harder it is to pull back. That's why, you know, when Sontag was giving that account of the outbreak of the war in 1939, he said that this point had contemporary relevance. In the nuclear age, these problems of deterrence, what would happen if both sides opt for deterrence strategies? You know, they're quite serious, and we can get insight into the fact that these are real problems by looking at the story of the outbreak of the war in Europe in September 1939. No plan. The first few months of the war, they called it the phony war, because neither side was conducting offensive military operations against the other. And it was not until the spring of 1940 that the Germans came up with with what people consider a very clever plan for attacking France. And within 6 weeks after the launch of their Western offensive, France had fallen. Now, this is a big surprise, not least to the United States, because the Americans felt like Britain and France were perfectly strong enough to hold their own against Germany. They might not be able to conquer Germany, but they could defend their own territory against Germany. As long as that was the case, America didn't have to intervene. But with the fall of France in June of 1940, America's calculations shifted dramatically. Yeah, America's calculations shifted. America, or President Roosevelt, reached the decision, this very important decision, at the time of the fall of France, that America could not afford to allow Britain to fall as well. For the sake of our own security, not for any sentimental attachment to the motherland or anything like that. And that meant that the Americans would have to do what they could to keep Britain afloat. And in effect, it was quite clear, ultimately, that America herself would have to intervene in this war. And why was this? Because just simply giving Britain material aid might be enough to prevent the British from falling. But you couldn't expect the British forever to go on fighting a war where there was absolutely no chance of victory. Right. What really kept the British afloat was the hope that America would eventually intervene. And that was, and once they lost hope of that, then they would certainly reach an accommodation with the Germans, and certainly, you know, at least that was Roosevelt's fear. But he had this big problem. Namely, the American public and the fact that the United States is a democracy. And that he couldn't just take the country into the war just by deciding to do it. It was restrained by American public opinion. A lot of this was part of the price that was paid for the failure of the Wilson policy during the First World War. You know, the last time we had intervened, it ended in this disastrous, unstable peace. What's the point of intervening again? You know, this. Those were the attitudes that lay at the heart of what was called isolationism, that lay at the heart of the effort to, you know, pass neutrality legislation to prevent the United States from sliding into war in as mindless a way, this time as she had done in 1917. Okay. What was Roosevelt to do? He had to accommodate the public opinion, especially in the run-up to the presidential elections in 1940, when Roosevelt was running for an unprecedented third term, only president, of course, in American history to have more than two terms. And when his Republican rival started playing the peace card and suggesting that Roosevelt wasn't going to keep the country out of war, Roosevelt was advised by his strategist that he had to kind of make very firm commitments about being a peace candidate, which he did, promising the country that America's young men weren't going to be sent off to foreign countries to die. I should say the same thing had happened with Wilson running for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And President Johnson, when he's running for re-election in 1964, also made the same kind of promise about not sending American boys off to die and fight wars that Asian boys should be fighting. But Roosevelt's hands were to a certain extent tied until he was reelected. And even then, he still had to worry about public opinion and about opposition to an interventionist policy in the Congress. Well, what was important about this? The importance lay in its effect on German policy. The Germans calculated, after the fall of France, that they had only a certain window of opportunity to move. They couldn't just sit on their hands and wait until Roosevelt was able to maneuver his country into the war. They felt that an American intervention was simply a matter of time. And that being the case, they had to take preemptive action. By doing what? By clearing the decks in the East. By destroying Soviet power. Because if the Soviet Union were intact by the time the American intervened, Germany would have a big problem. That would embolden the Soviets. Germany would have to face the prospect, in effect, of a conflict on two fronts. But if the Soviet Union were destroyed before America intervened, and Germany could concentrate all of her military power in destroying the Soviet Union, then the new German empire, this new German superstate that controlled all of continental Europe up to the Urals, this country would be unconquerable. The Germans would be able to eventually organize all the areas that she had conquered and harness their resources to her war machine. She would have the advantage of, you know, internal lines of communication. Be very hard for the United States to deal with a German superpower of that sort. Okay? And it was for this reason that Hitler decided to attack the Soviet Union when he did. He made the decision right after the fall of France in mid-1940. He set the spring of 1941 as the earliest but also the latest possible date for a German attack on Russia. Earliest because the Germans needed time to prepare for the attack, but latest because he had the America factor in mind. There's a terrific German scholar named Andreas Hilgruber has a wonderful article on what he calls the America factor in German foreign policy in this period.
Wait, what time was this? 1941, which month?
Which month that the spring of 41, and the original plan was for May, and the event, it was postponed for a month, and they attacked in June of 1941. But it's, you know, it's that ballpark figure. We got to move before the Americans build up their power and able to intervene in the war against us. Because otherwise, we're hopeless. The Germans had a window of opportunity, to use a concept we associate with international relations theorists. A window of opportunity. And it's pushed them forward. Now, the interesting thing is that German policy of moving forward in order to preempt the Americans and American intervention had its effect on America's policy. Especially after the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941, American strategists thought that they were under time pressure to move to deal with this emerging German threat. The very thing that Hitler was hoping for the American leadership, this was something to be guarded against. Because if the Americans just sat on their hands and did nothing while Germany not just conquered Russia, but organized all of the conquered areas and harnessed their resources to the German war machine, then the situation from the American standpoint would be essentially unmanageable. In the long run, it was felt that even the survival of the United States would be in question. The resources that Germany controlled might actually be stronger than America's resources. And this implied intervention. Now, these arguments were laid out quite explicitly at the time. The most important document was something that historians call the Victory Program, dated September 11th, 1941. In other words, 60 years to the date before the attacks on New York and Washington. And what was the argument about the Victory Program? Simply that it was an argument that was produced by the top military leadership, by the Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall, and the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Harold Stark. The whole argument of the Victory Program was not just that if the United States gets involved in war, it should focus on dealing with Germany, since Germany was a more dangerous threat than Japan was. The argument was, we got to get into the war, the sooner the better. Because it's going to take Germany about 2 years, they calculated, to pull order out of chaos in the areas that Germany had conquered. And but when that happened, Germany would be essentially, the German problem would be unmanageable. The German Empire, unconquerable, had all these advantages, certainly not at a cost that the American people would be willing to pay. Okay? So we got to get into the war. But the more the Americans were pushed toward intervention, the stronger the incentive was for Hitler to kind of move ahead and take action that would enable him to deal with a possible American intervention before it was too late. So you have this dynamic going on there, a dynamic that international relations theory, window theory, this whole business of windows of opportunity, windows of vulnerability. Talked about this a little bit at the time of one of the first lectures about the Schlieffen Plan and so on. These windows, window logic, plays a very important role in international politics in this period as well. Okay, so what was Roosevelt's policy? It evolves in the course of the year 1941. As indeed American opinion evolves. You know, a lot of it is we have to support Britain because Britain is doing our fighting for us. If Britain fell, then we would have to go into the war in a much more direct way. But if we want to avoid direct involvement in the war, we have to support Britain. So the argument for supporting Britain was designed in such a way as to play to isolationist sentiment. And it was that sort of argument. Not the argument that the British are fighting our fight, we got to get into the war sooner or later. It was that argument that enabled Roosevelt to get the Lend-Lease Bill through the Congress at the beginning of 1941.
Wait, you said the U.S. supported Britain not because Britain was fighting?
They supported Britain. The official argument, the official rationale for supporting Britain was that we don't have to actually do the fighting. They'll do our fighting for us. We'll give them the goods. We'll give them the tools. We'll give them the weapons. And that means that we don't actually have to send our soldiers into battle, right? Or put our sailors in harm's way. Okay? It was. What can I say? The whole Roosevelt policy, it was not a straightforward policy. It was not like he said, Britain is sooner or later we're going to have to come in the war. In the meantime, we have to make sure that Britain doesn't fall, but let's not kid ourselves. Eventually, we're going to have to put our own bodies on the line. Oh, the American people didn't want to hear that. So they came up with a more palatable way of packaging the policy of preventing the fall of Britain, saying, oh, this will enable us to avoid intervention in the war. This whole business of do the leaders of democracies, are they straight with their own people? And every time it comes up, George W. Bush or Lyndon Johnson, whatever, people are totally shocked, you know? It's like that scene from Casablanca, you know? And say, like, I'm shocked to discover that there's gambling going on in this casino. It's like, it's built into the very structure of the system, especially in democratic countries. Why? Because the political leadership lives in the rough and tumble world of international politics, and they can't afford to ignore power political realities. You know, if there's this German threat that's emerging, they have to think in terms of, we got to get in before the Germans attack us. We can't just sit on our hands and allow the Germans the power to decide when the conflict should start. They think, people like Roosevelt, they think in those terms. But the American people says, oh, we shouldn't ever go to a war for power political reasons. To go to a war for the sake of the balance of power, that's bad. That's 19th century European way of looking at things. We should only go into war when we ourselves are attacked, right? We can only go to the war for purely defensive purposes. And so what this means is that the political leadership, which takes a much more sophisticated view, has to frame its policies in a way that in effect plays to those public prejudices, that panders to public attitudes. And you see it over and over again. You see, it's like you can't get too upset about it because you see how it's built into the very structure of things. You know, the political leadership, they live in these two worlds, the rough and tumble world of international politics, which pushes them toward power political conceptions, and then also the world of domestic politics, where they have to play to the usual prejudices of the public, a public that has not been trained to think in any particularly sophisticated way about these issues of foreign policy, and never will be. something that just has to be accepted. You know, this is the sort of thing that, that drove someone like George Kennan crazy. You know, you read that article of his, and he says, this is a problem of democracies. They find it really hard to conduct a rational policy based on serious power political considerations. Okay. So Roosevelt's moving in this direction. He has to deal with a lot of public opposition, although the public opposition is diminishing as the German threat becomes more and more palpable. And following the German attack on the Soviet Union in June, there's this shift on Roosevelt's part and part of American policy in general. He meets with Churchill at Argentia, off the coast of Newfoundland, in August of 1941. You know, he tells Churchill, and we know this in the British records that were declassified in 1972, says, and this does not appear in any of the American sources, he says, my goal is to wage war without declaring it. I intend to become more and more provocative in our naval operations in the North Atlantic, and if Hitler doesn't like it, he can declare war on us. Right? That's practically a verbatim quote from what Roosevelt told Churchill. And in fact, in the latter part of the year, beginning right after Argentia, the United States conducts an undeclared naval war in the North Atlantic. You know, dropping over 80 depth charges, for example, on real or suspected German submarines in this period. It was prior to Pearl Harbor. You know, at one point, it seemed like a German battleship was about to kind of try and break into the Atlantic from its base in Norway. The Americans sent this big task force to deal with that. You know, didn't happen because of mechanical problems on the German side. But the Americans are quite interested in conducting as vigorous a naval campaign as they can, given the limited resources at their disposal. And again, we're paying the price during this period for the failure to rearm in the years before the war. After the fall of France, you know, a big rearmament bill was passed, but it takes a long time to kind of, you know, build ships and so on. So the rearmament decisions of mid-1940 had not yet paid off in terms of military and especially naval end products by late 1941. But Hitler has his hands full with Russia. During this period, and to the fury of his naval commanders, he orders them to avoid responding to these American provocations, and to avoid giving Roosevelt any pretext for bringing his country into the war against Germany. All right. So the policy that Roosevelt had laid out at Argentia, it wasn't doing the trick. But fortunately, for Roosevelt, he had a second string in his bow, a second iron in his fire. And that has to do with the situation in the Far East. So let me talk about that a little bit. Because it's important to remember that the war came, American intervention in the war, in the European war came, not as a result of the naval operations in the Atlantic, but rather as a result of the attack on Pearl Harbor and in the Pacific. In passing, let me note that the mere fact that America was pursuing as active a policy as it was shows you how wrong Taylor was to claim that the United States was a country that, quote, asked only to be left alone, and that Hitler's decision to go to war with America was gratuitous. That America had turned its back on Europe, so why on earth would Hitler do this? Not true. America is playing a very active role in this story, a key role in this story. So it was the Pearl Harbor attack that led to German intervention in the war. How is that possible? Why did the Germans do that? Why did the Germans, you know, basically say, Now that America has our hands full with Japan, we don't have to declare war in America. We're relatively free to just move ahead with our policy of, you know, conquering the Soviet Union. And how's the Pacific War itself to be understood? Again, the traditional American view is, oh, Pearl Harbor attack? Bolts from the blue. Peace-loving country, the United States. You know, just perfectly willing to mind its own business. You know, the Japanese, crazy, militaristic, you know, leadership just, you know, attacks this peace-loving America. You know, all those ideas that you get from, you know, what you're taught in high school and so on. Do they stand up in the light of the evidence? Again, it's the same point that we made about Germany. Why would Germany attack America if she was involved in this campaign against Russia? She had hands full in Russia. Same point applies to the Pacific War. Here's Japan bogged down in China. They've been fighting this war in China since 1937. No hope of victory. Okay. And what? And Japan, with their hands full in China, is going to gratuitously pick a conflict with by far the strongest country in the world, a country which she knew she couldn't defeat. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's like, well, that kind of consideration is like a loose thread in the whole fabric of the conventional wisdom, of the received interpretation. You begin to pull on that loose thread and the whole fabric begins to unravel. Okay? Because it turns out American policy vis-a-vis Japan was by no means passive. It wasn't the case at all that America had was pursuing an isolationist policy. Might not like what Japan was doing in East Asia, but we weren't going to go to war to prevent her from doing it. That is not true. And the key event here was the decision to impose an oil embargo on Japan. An embargo was imposed at the very end of July 1941. Okay. What was the effect of the embargo? This is a very important point. It's like the logic of the situation established by the Schlieffen Plan was an important point. Similarly, the logic of the situation established by the embargo was important. What was important about the embargo? It put the United States and Japan on a collision course. Why was this the case? Because Japan needed oil. She needed to import oil. Why? Not because she needed oil for her industrial economy. Her industrial economy was still a coal-based economy. She needed liquid fuels, however, for military purposes, including naval purposes. Without liquid fuels, her whole military effort in Japan would bog down. It's a motorized army. It needs, you know, gasoline and so on. And if that happened, her military position in China would collapse. So to avoid a collapse of her position in China, Japan needed to get oil. How can Japan get oil? One of two ways. Either through reaching an agreement with the United States that allowed the oil deliveries to resume. The American embargo, I should say, also included the British and the Dutch, and America, Britain, and Holland. Together they controlled practically, you know, all of the exportable oil in the world. You reach an agreement with America that allows the deliveries to resume, some of which, by the way, came from California. It's hard to believe nowadays that California is exporting oil. You still see some of those old oil fields, oil, you know, rigs pumping away. If you ever come back from the airport with La Cienega, you see them on your right. Either by reaching an agreement with America or by seizing the oil-producing areas within striking range of the Japanese armed forces, namely the oil-producing areas in the Dutch East Indies. What was then the Dutch East Indies, today Indonesia. But the Americans made it clear that if the Japanese did that, that would mean war with America. And so the question was, what about reaching an agreement? And here the important thing to note is that the American terms for an agreement were exceptionally severe. Basically, we were demanding that Japan simply pull out of China, capitulate on the China issue, write off everything that she had been doing in China since 1937. And the American leadership knew that it was very unlikely that the Japanese would accept such a total and massive defeat, that Japan would, in fact, capitulate to those American demands in that way. I'll just read you. This is from Roosevelt's closest advisor in these matters, Undersecretary of State Sumner Welles. And Welles wrote, this is November 1941, that the Japanese leaders had to provide some justification to their own people after 4 years of national effort and sacrifice in China. Welles, therefore, could not believe that the Japanese would agree to evacuate China completely. This is a document, by the way. But nothing less, he said, would satisfy the United States. Okay? So it was for this reason that the embargo put the United States and Japan on a collision course. The Japanese were given a choice. Either abandon your aspirations in China or face war with the United States. Right. Did they understand that this was the goal? Well, that's an important question. You look at the historical literature, and historians are wrestling with a problem. Today, everyone can see what the effect of the embargo was. And yet the assumption was Roosevelt didn't want a war with Japan. Especially those historians who say he really wanted to take the United States into the war against Nazi Germany. The last thing he should have wanted is a second war with Japan, if he could avoid it at all. So he didn't want a war with Japan, but he adopted a policy that led directly to a war with Japan. How do you square that circle? How do you make sense of this? And they came up with these two separate arguments. One argument is, oh, he didn't understand what he was doing. He thought that the aim of the embargo was to deter Japan. He didn't realize that it would provoke Japan. And then the other argument is, well, whether he understood the implications of the embargo or not, he had lost control of policy. Policy had devolved. Effective control of policy had fallen into the hands of these mid-level officials in the State Department, people like Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who essentially hijacked the policy. You know, it's like you're reading the Utley book for this week. You'll see that that's the argument that Utley makes, right? Roosevelt had lost control of policy. He didn't want war, but the policy was put into effect because he lost control. Right? When you think about it, those are the only two explanations that you could come up with to explain how it was possible for America to adopt this sort of policy without Roosevelt deliberately wanting to put America and Japan on a collision course, right? Because if Roosevelt understood what the implications of the embargo were, and he authorized the embargo knowing full well what its implications were, then you would have to view the policy as deliberate. So for the policy not to be deliberate, either he did not understand what the implications were, or he had lost control. So therefore, we've unpacked the argument. We could look at each of those claims one by one. Did he not understand it? It's very, very clear that he understood it. Again, I'll just this is one of these things from Sumner Welles. This is just before the embargo was imposed. He recognized that tough economic sanctions would, quote, provoke Japan to war with America before long. They understood what the implications were. Roosevelt understood that an oil embargo would push the Japanese down into the Indies, and that would mean war in the Pacific, which is why he had resisted the proposals for the embargo prior to the end of July. Okay, and the argument about losing control, it turns out that Roosevelt, through Welles, understood what was going on, authorized it from the very outset. We have two basic proofs of this. One was some documents that another historian named Heinrichs, Waldo Heinrichs, found in some obscure part of the archives showing that Acheson was taking instructions from Welles. And the other thing is the British records of what went on at the Argentia Conference and right after the embargo was imposed. It's very clear from what both Welles and Roosevelt said that the embargo was going to be maintained intact, and a very strong embargo. We put these things together. The conclusion is irrefutable. Roosevelt deliberately put the United States on a collision course with Japan. But why on earth would he do that when his real goal was to take the United States into the war against Germany? Japan wasn't the problem. Okay. His military advisors were all telling him that, you know, it's crazy to provoke a second war with Japan when we really should concentrate on the true danger, which is Nazi Germany. Okay? And Roosevelt generally went along with the whole kind of thinking that conclusion on the part of the military officials was based on. So therefore, if he opted for the other sort of policy, the policy that led to the war with Japan, something must have come into play that tipped the balance in the other direction. And what could that something possibly be? It seems to me the only answer there is that this was the only way of bringing the United States into the war against Germany fast enough. Right? America might come in eventually without doing that, but time was of the essence, according to the thinking of the military leadership themselves. Roosevelt, the constraints on how fast Roosevelt can move and bring the United States into the European war were quite serious. Constraints having to do with domestic political opinion at home. And when news of the Pearl Harbor attack was received in Washington, what was the reaction of Roosevelt and his top collaborators? They were very pleased, very happy. You know, they felt like, well, the feeling was we're going to have to get into the war with Germany sooner or later, and this had given us the opportunity. You know, time was of the essence. There was relief, right? Right. Very, very different, right? This is very different from the sort of interpretation that you've been kind of fed in school. But you notice the light that the story throws on these fundamental issues of international relations theory, about the fundamental importance of the strategic balance and of shifts in the strategic balance in shaping the behavior of all the participants, that no one is in total control of events, that these events are not to be understood in terms of aggressors pressing the button and starting wars. She had a question, and then I'll get you, and then we'll probably have to break. What was your question?
For FDR losing control of, like, the bureaucracy, and what was your argument in regard? Did you think he lost control?
No! Use the technique that I laid out with the Taylor book in examining the Utley book. Try and see what sort of evidence Utley gives to support that argument. The argument that he didn't lose control, this is the argument based on this evidence that Heinrichs found showing that these bureaucrats were receiving the instructions essentially from Roosevelt himself. Right? You had a question? Yeah?
How did Roosevelt know that Germany would declare war on the U.S. if the U.S. got in war with Japan?
Oh, there are two answers to that. That's a good question. Number one is the Japanese were desperate to avoid this war with America and wanted to go very, very far in terms of avoiding this war. They made this clear in all kinds of ways. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to really go into this. And this, the Germans knew about this, and this scared the Germans that Japan was about to reach an accommodation with the United States and in effect isolate Germany. So to buck up the Japanese and support the pro-German elements within the Japanese government, the Nazis gave the Japanese all these assurances. If you go to war with America, even if you start it, we will support you. And the Americans had decoded the Japanese diplomatic traffic. And also the British had decoded a lot of the German sources. So the Americans knew that the Germans were making these promises to Japan. But even beyond that, if Japan attacked at Pearl Harbor, whether Hitler then proceeded to declare a war on the United States or not, the American government felt it could then declare war on Hitler itself because the American public had come to view Japan and Germany as part of a criminal conspiracy and was willing to hold Germany responsible for whatever Japan did. It's there's a lot of evidence on all these things. One last question before we break.
You said that Germans were making promises to Japan to defend Japan, right?
To come into the war on the side of Japan.
Right. Why would they make that promise?
Because they're afraid that if they don't give Japan that promise, Japan would feel isolated and Japan will make a deal with the Americans, and that would lead to total German isolation. Okay? Next time, it's going to try and review all the stuff that we've covered this part of the course. So come prepared for questions, with questions or whatever. The aim is to kind of help you right before the midterm.